Passed in 1997, the Pennsylvania Charter Law has vastly altered the landscape of public education in the state. This is Multiple Choices, a Keystone Crossroads podcast that pulls back the curtain on issues of schools and money in Pennsylvania. I'm your host, Kevin McCrory, and today we're looking at nearly 20 years of charter schools in the state. Joining me is Paul Sokolar, editor-in-chief and publisher of the Philadelphia Public School Notebook. Now, Paul, charters, I mean, this is one of the most contentious, confusing, complex topics there are to deal with in education. Am I right?
You're right, and I have my crib sheets here with me to help us through it.
Okay, well, some say that the charter law no doubt created competition that spurred reforms that have helped the system overall. Others say it's exacerbated inequalities and inequities and has crippled the schools tasked with serving the most vulnerable student populations. Now, before we get into that, though, it's useful just to remind ourselves, what makes a charter school different than a district school? We know they're both public schools, right?
That's correct. A charter school, though, is authorized normally by a local school district and is freed from a number of regulations that apply to district schools.
What kind of regulations?
The one that gets cited most often is that charters are allowed to have a percentage of non-certified teachers.
They don't work with teachers' unions typically, too, right?
Well, when a charter forms, it's not going to have a teachers' union. The teacher unions are increasingly trying to organize charter schools, but by and large, you're right.
What are there other big differences between charters and district schools besides the unionization and the employment?
Well, charters are covered by, you know, laws about transparency and Sunshine Act that requires public meetings to be open and so on. Charters are nonprofits. The governing boards are nonprofit boards. And so the procedures governing them are in some ways different. They're covered by all the laws that apply to nonprofits.
All right, Paul. So we're talking about charter schools here. There's a lot of questions about funding. Where is that funding for a student in a charter school? Where's it coming from?
So this is the basic difference, that the funding is coming from the district that granted the charter. So the district writes checks to charters on a monthly basis for the students that they are serving.
So the state isn't sending a check to a charter school?
Not the basic education funding. That's not where it's coming from. There may be reimbursement for rent or some other state grant money, but the operating costs from charters are coming directly from the school district that gave the charter.
Okay, so in Philadelphia, there's 203,000 students, both district and charter. All that money is funneling through the Philadelphia School District and then out into either its own schools or charter schools.
Exactly, yeah. So we've got 60-some thousand students in Philadelphia in brick-and-mortar charters, and the district is writing a check every month for a per-pupil amount for each of those students who are in charters.
If we went back in time, you know, the magical land of the late 90s, Tom Ridge was governor, Seinfeld was hot, right? What was the idea behind these charter schools? What was the reason? What was the rationale?
The idea was hot nationally, and Pennsylvania was not the first to jump on the bandwagon. I think Minnesota was the first state to get into charters. I think the basic premise was that charters could be a hothouse for innovation, that if you freed schools up from regulation, that there could be types of experimentation that weren't happening in district schools, that you could have schools that focused on a particular interest or a particular neighborhood and could do some things differently than traditional district schools, which at that time, I think it was fair to say that a lot of districts, the norm was kind of cookie cutter schools.
I mean, there was a pretty big push in that time for vouchers, right? You know, the ability for a kid going to a Catholic school to get a portion of their tuition, or if not all of it, paid for by state funds. And was the charter movement kind of seen as like a voucher light?
I think by some people it was, some critics especially it was, but, you know, the initial impetus for charter schools was really pretty bipartisan. The American Federation of Teachers president, Albert Shanker, was on board with the idea. So, you know, I think we've seen some increasing polarization over time, but initially, I think, you know, you saw folks from a variety of different political camps, whereas the voucher movement, you know, was more strongly associated with conservative politics.
Okay, so at this point, though, it has become pretty toxic. What do you think has created this atmosphere? It feels like, you know, as a writer, if I say something about a charter school or a district school, I have to make sure that I'm lining my stuff up because I'm going to hear about it in the comments of the public school notebook.
Right, right. Well, we're parked here in Philadelphia, and I think the biggest single factor that has made it toxic is the way that charters are funded, that there's really just no question that charters are a drain on traditional district schools and that the funding formula sets up a kind of a fierce competition for very scarce resources between the charter sector and the district sector.
Explain that. I mean, we hear the term stranded costs talked about a lot. Is that what you're talking about here?
That's kind of the catchphrase that's used, and I think it helps explain a lot of it. So stranded costs, basically, it captures the idea that, let's say you have 1% of a district's population move from district schools to charter schools, that there is not accompanying automatic 1% reduction in costs that can happen.
That teacher is still there. They're still paying for the heating bill.
Yeah. Part of it is that there's district overhead, but I think the big thing is that if you have the same number of schools, same number of district schools, you've got school-based overhead, and charters draw from, in most cases, they're drawing from multiple schools. So if you have 400 kids moving into a charter, it doesn't mean that there's any one school that you can shut down. I think a big thing in terms of the whole cost issue is that it's never really been contemplated that every time you open a charter school, you're going to have a corresponding closure of a public school. You know, when
do you think that's fair? That it's 1-to-1 that way. I guess over years.
I think in terms of the cost issue, that it pretty much would have to be to not set up this kind of fierce competition. And when Philadelphia was opening dozens of charters in the late 90s and the early 2000s, that was not part of the conversation. There was no contemplation that if you don't close a district school for every charter school that you open, you've got a system that is paying for one more principal, one more building engineer, one more counselor, you know, all the costs associated with the maintenance of the building and so on. I guess that's really at the heart of the issue of stranded costs.
If we were just to widen out another second here, and if we were just to say, like, you know, we started this conversation 20 years now in Pennsylvania, almost 20 years, there's been these things called charter schools. Has it been a net positive?
There are really big pluses and there are big minuses. You know, I think it's unquestionably true that there are some amazing charter schools out there and that some of the more exciting schools in Philadelphia, which is the landscape I know, are charter schools. But, you know, at the same time, it has set up this incredible competition and polarization. And, you know, it's also part of the polarization, I think, is that the education debates are very much pro-charter, anti-charter, pro-district, anti-district. And I think it's gotten us away from focusing on what are the factors that really make for high-quality education.
You sound like you're running for mayor now, Paul.
Maybe I should.
The real staunch education reform camp, who tend to be allied with, you know, the more fiscal conservatives in the state of Pennsylvania, say that there's no doubt that charters have been a net positive, specifically for the urban districts where they're mainly clustered. One of those folks is Steve Miskin, longtime spokesman for Republican leaders in the Pennsylvania House of Representatives.
parents are making their choice. They want the option. There are a number of very good charters that are helping kids and giving parents and those kids the option to read, write, and do math, and they're doing well.
So it's as simple as that to Steve Miskin. I mean, he represents Speaker of the House Mike Terzai, who in this recent debate about should Philadelphia authorize new charter schools or not, was saying that we should do close to 30. What about his very sunny outlook on this? Do you, I guess, doubt?
It's just not as simple as that, that creating a charter means that you're creating a better school. Some are, some aren't. And, it doesn't appear to be because it's a charter that it's a better school.
Like we've been saying, Philadelphia has, specifically embraced this charter movement. We were kind of a hub of experimentation, it seems, through the 2000s and maybe
right.
even this decade, right? The term that you hear to describe what we have here in Philadelphia is the so-called portfolio model, right, where schools are kind of like seen as stocks. You bet on the higher-performing schools, and then you sell or close the lower-performing schools. What do you think of the pros and cons of that portfolio model?
I think the portfolio model has some real problems, and this really relates back to the issue of are you prepared to close a school for every new school that you open? I think that's not always put on the table when we're talking about the portfolio. And we found it really hard to close schools in Philadelphia, and that's true both of district schools and charter schools. Sometimes it's, maybe not for totally rational reasons, but school communities have very intense attachments to their schools. We've got a pretty cumbersome process in terms of closing charter schools in Pennsylvania. So you've got some schools that have basically been on the list for several years now, still aren't closed. They can appeal. They can appeal ultimately to the court system to try to fight to keep open. So it's not like you call your broker and sell your stock. It's a much more complicated process and a very really emotional process when you're talking about closing schools.
That's just a lot of stress and transition on the student body, right? I mean, a school closed and now they have to find a new school, and that just pushes people from school to school to some degree. I mean, there's a harmful effect on the kid.
There's probably unquestionably times when it's the right thing to do.
Sure.
But it's really doing it or, talking about closing schools to the extent that I think the portfolio model contemplates or that proponents of charters, of opening dozens of charters, are contemplating, I think takes us to a whole new place in education that where we haven't really been, of just, okay, are we assuming then that we're also going to close dozens of schools, and is that something we really want to do? Do we want to risk, in some cases, leaving communities without a neighborhood school?
Well, there are proponents of that. Let's go back to Steve Miskin.
The more kids of a district that go to a charter, it allows you, and you can't do it, snap your fingers and have it done, but you can now start shutting down those schools that fail. Going back to the crime is sending kids to a school that you know for a fact is not teaching those kids.
He uses a kind of a loaded terminology there that you hear often in these debates, which is a failing school. And he's frankly saying that it's a positive thing because you're closing a failing school and that we know those kids are in a better school. Of course, it's not as simple as that, though, right, Paul?
I don't think so. And for one thing, defining what is a failing school is not so easy. Are we going to do that just on the basis of the PSSA, which we know has some problems? And we also know with test scores that, basically they correlate pretty closely with the income of the population that the school serves. So all kinds of debates in education about, if a school is less than 50% proficient, is that a failing school? Maybe if all the kids coming in were proficient when they came in and are not anymore, then it's pretty clear cut. But, a school that is 40, 50% proficient might be starting with kids who were starting at zero.
At the top of this conversation, I'd asked you, why has this charter district thing become so toxic? And you pointed to funding, but it does. It's essentially more than that, right? Because like you said, there's going to have to be a corresponding school that
closes down eventually, and what is the criteria going to be? So that's where we get into who were the kids in that charter school, and how did they get there, and are they there because they're going to pass the test better and make that school look better, right? So there's incentives in the system for a charter school, say, to not serve, you know, the kids who are the most difficult to serve. There's not incentives for the school district schools to do that either necessarily, but there are these things called neighborhood schools, which those kids just end up in, right?
Proponents of charters talk a lot about people voting with their feet for charters, and there's certainly some evidence of that, but you got to look at all the factors that are involved in that. For instance, transportation. Right now in the Philadelphia School District, you can get bused to a charter school that's not your neighborhood school, and you don't have that option to say, I want to go to that district school over there and sign up and get on a bus to do that. So yes, people are unquestionably opting out of their neighborhood schools and going to charter schools, but it's not a level playing field in terms of people having that same option for district schools.
But going back to your point as well, I mean, like you said, there are some amazing charter schools in this city that you can understand why there would be a demand for people to go to those schools. So It just becomes a pretty complex issue. You can't just say one is one thing or one is the other in the system, especially when we're talking about these are real kids' lives on the line. These are real parents who are trying to figure out what's best for their kid, right? And it often just becomes this really politicized, toxic conversation.
Right. You know, I think there's no question that school systems have to get more responsive to parental choice about where families want their children to go. At the same time, we've got this idea of neighborhood schools that still seems to have a lot of weight with parents and families. And we're seeing this in Philadelphia in terms of groups cropping up, friends of this school
sure.
or that school, where the folks in a neighborhood are determined to try to upgrade the quality of the neighborhood school. How do we balance these, you know, two ideas of parental choice and also strong desire of people to be able to send their kids to a school in the neighborhood? And that makes a lot of sense.
I mean, a recent anecdote last spring, again, talking about Philadelphia, just because that's where so much of this charter conversation happens, right? The school district of Philadelphia said, here are two of our what they considered low-performing schools. And they said, these are charter operators that we would like to take over these schools through their Renaissance initiative. So essentially, they're still neighborhood schools, but the charters run them. And they put it to a vote of parents. And in both situations, the parents voted to stay a district neighborhood school. There's all sorts of contradictory conversations you can have, I guess, in that, because the narrative does sometimes become parents want charter schools. They're marching with their feet. They're showing us, you know, the policies that they want. And in this situation, they voted against it. And of course, when that happened, the response was, well, that was the teachers union. The teachers union pressured these parents into saying, oh, you don't want to lose
right.
Susie Q's teacher, right? And so, again, it becomes this toxic thing, and it's really hard to tell at all what's happening.
Yeah, I think the issue around the Philadelphia Renaissance schools that parents voted down, I mean, clearly there was some union advocacy around that, but they must have tapped something also. And, you know, I don't know to what extent it's skepticism about charters. I think some of it is definitely interest in the idea of the traditional neighborhood school.
I want to go back to one of the things you mentioned earlier, you know, just with this portfolio model and having charters and having, you know, that's a new principal and it's a new counselor and it's a new, you know, school building and all that. Just the inefficiency of having, in Philadelphia, for instance, we have 84 charter schools run by, I don't know the exact number of operators, but, you know, a relative.
Close to that number.
Close to that number of operators. And then you have the school district itself, which has 200 some schools.
Right.
So there's these efficiencies that are kind of lost. You lose the economy of scale in there. And you can argue that, you know, the most efficient way to educate the 200,000 kids in Philadelphia would be to just have one system that is a lean, mean, efficient machine that knows how to run that system. But that's not what we have.
Yeah, those days seem to be gone.
Right.
Yeah.
And Donna Cooper, Executive Director of Public Citizens for Children and Youth, referenced this when we talked recently. And she pointed to New Orleans, which, you know, went all charter recently, and said that their school transportation costs spiked since they moved to that all charter model.
So while it might have been seen as a way to generate greater efficiency, again, the long-term consequences of decentralizing economies of scale were not understood or thought out, and we are going to see greater inefficiency in school spending probably in Philadelphia akin to that in New Orleans.
So she's saying it wasn't thought out, and maybe this is all just the growing pains of a new movement of public education. It's 20 years old, but that's really not that old. So maybe it's just this whole system has to work itself out, and we just need to figure out the new world order of district schools and charter schools, or what do you think, Paul?
I think there's some figuring out that definitely still needs to happen. To me, I guess the bottom line, and this is a financial bottom line, is that you're talking about a system that is way more complicated. You know, that we used to have these unified school districts and one transportation office and curriculum office and so on. And now you're talking about really dozens of school districts. I mean, the charters Right. are their own school districts. And I think the recognition that is not there in terms of how charters are funded in Pennsylvania is that if you're creating a more complex school system, you have to have a associated revenue to cover the expenditures of that complexity. Pennsylvania had at one time a charter school reimbursement formula where every district that sent students to charter schools, or at least over a certain threshold, that there was some compensation for each student that left, and that built in the kind of understanding that, yes, this costs more and we're running this hybrid system now and the district needs help. And we moved away from that. That was something that former Governor Corbett did in his first budget. Now this winter, Governor Wolf is talking about bringing that back in some form, and it's reflected to a very small degree in his initial budget proposal.
So if we had to just boil it down to its essential, school choice is a concept that's great and has a lot of potential and has provided a lot of opportunities, but there's just real costs associated with it that sometimes just haven't been reflected in the budgets that school districts have seen.
That's true, and you know, there also is this competition between the idea of choice and the idea of the neighborhood school, and you know, it seems like the public is torn on that.
Well, I think we're going to have to leave it at that today, Paul. And that will conclude this episode of Multiple Choices. Paul Sokolar, Philadelphia Public School Notebook Editor-in-Chief and Publisher, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Kevin.